Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to All Stats Aren't We, a podcast in which Leeds fans cast their combined eye over goings on at Elland Road, giving scrutiny to the underlying statistics and tactical footings at work at Leeds United. I'm John McKenzie. That we've already had three draws this season, only two more to go till we hit last season's tally of the podcast. All draws, aren't we? And I'm joined by the we're already struggling to get enough people on the podcast of the podcast. They only podcast when they're winning. It's Darren Driver. Darren, how are you?
I'm here again to take the shit end of the stick, John. But you know, it's always fine. I always enjoy talking to you about football, and we don't need the rest of them anyway. So yeah, how are you, John? Are you well this morning?
Yeah, I'm doing well. I made the executive decision last night that I play football on Friday nights, and I decided that, you know what, I was going to go and play football and not worry too much about Leeds United. So I've had a weird experience of this game because I watched the game back after the fact last night, and I watched it again this morning. I think it's just a general truism that when you watch the game back, not live, you always think of it as being slightly better than the general crowd consensus during the game. And I can understand that like this, because I think the narrative thing is a lot heavier then, isn't it? Sort of like, this is where we're at, we need to win this game. It doesn't happen. All of the frustrations boil over. Whereas I think when you watch it back, knowing the score, it's slightly different. So I listened to the second half on the radio driving back from the football, but I didn't think this was too bad, but we will get into it.
The question on everyone's lips here, John, is how did you play?
I actually played okay. It was a first run out for the foreshore shirt, and I midfield marshalled my team to victory, picked up a hat trick while doing so, you know.
Do you want a game on Saturday?
But thank you for asking. It's a rare good game for me. So, but let's jump into this game and try and pick some of the meat off the bones. So we'll start off with a game summary, which I've actually found fairly hard to do given various things. But it was a 1-1 draw against Newcastle United away from home. Felt like the game was hard to summarise in terms of periods. It seemed as though the consensus was that Leeds looked good in the first half and less so in the second, but it seemed to me that there wasn't a huge amount of difference between the two halves, really. I think we created chances, unsurprisingly, largely in transition in both halves. You were saying, Darren, before we went on air, that you were maybe frustrated that we didn't make more of the fact that Newcastle got a bit more ragged as the game went on. We didn't seem to capitalise on that. And I do think that in our game so far, we've actually seen Leeds start off fairly positively and then sort of fade away a little bit. So no doubt that'll be something that we can talk about. Structurally, there was no surprises, really. We had picked that there was going to probably be a 4-4-2 before the game, that Newcastle were probably going to play in a 3-5-2 or a 3-4-3 I guess it, as it became, like a 5-2-3 at times. The only really interesting, like, tactical decision in terms of the lineup was Dallas at right back ahead of Shackleton, and I say that because Shackleton and Roberts were basically our only two potential starting options, and I don't think Roberts was ever going to be a starter in that midfield anyway. So that was the only really interesting thing about the lineup. Rodrigo played in the second striker position, which we will go on to talk about. But yeah, it was a fairly messy game, I think. Neither team really controlled the ball. I think Leeds had the majority of the possession, but it felt as though a lot of that possession was had at the back. We have talked at length on this podcast about controlling the ball in wide areas, but I didn't feel as though we were doing a huge amount of that. And I didn't really feel as though Newcastle felt the need to sit really deep through the whole game either. So again, a sort of case of Leeds not particularly excelling against a mid-blockish team. Although I didn't feel as though that Newcastle were necessarily pressing us in wide areas and trying to overload in those wide areas either. Leeds got their goal from probably their least likely chance of the evening, around 13 minutes. Rafinha crossing the ball in and it going through Rodrigo's legs. And Newcastle got their equaliser just before half-time through their least surprising outlet, Alan Saint-Maximin, who I think was a fairly bright spark for them throughout the game, as we, again, suggested would be the case. Although I don't think it necessarily takes a rocket scientist to pick out Newcastle's most attacking player at the moment. Then beyond that, Leeds brought off Daniel James for Tyler Roberts at 60 minutes, which I think was interesting because we've not really seen Tyler Roberts as a wide player before. And then we saw a debut for Crescencio Somerville on for Rafinha, which has been the thing that everyone's been clamouring for of late. So we finally got to see that. And then finally, Shackleton was brought on to replace the injured Luke Ayling, with Calvin Phillips dropping back into the centre-back space. I feel as though we've not really said anything about the game so far, because I do think, as we've said, it's a tricky game to sort of get anything out of. So let's kick off with the interrogation. This is the part of the show where I usually ask the other guys five questions, but in this case, I will ask Darren five questions. So sorry if you feel as if I'm putting you under the cosh a little bit here, Darren. But let's start off with the first question, which is, I watched the game after the fact, as I've said, and I was surprised at the assessment that I'd seen on Twitter. Perhaps it serves me right for taking Twitter too seriously, but how did you feel the game was on a rewatch?
Yeah, it was interesting. When I watched the game live yesterday, I really enjoyed the first half. I thought it was a lot of fun. I thought both teams, you know, made chances and stuff, and we definitely looked like the better team and like we were going to unpick them. And I felt relatively confident, even after Alan Saint-Maximin scored, that we would still go on and win the game if the game continued in the same pattern and if we continued to show the same sort of attacking. I don't know if quality is quite the right word to use, but if we continue to make as many chances as we did in the first half, I actually thought we started the second half quite well. I thought we played well for the first 10 or 15 minutes of the second half, and looked like we might still be able to unpick them. And I guess live yesterday, I made the mistake of going into the All Stats group chat during the second half, which I didn't do at all during the first half. And you know, I think. Some of the reading of the game yesterday was compounded by some of the substitutions, which at the time seemed baffling. Like, obviously bringing Somerville off for Rafinha at the time seemed very strange, and it becomes clear now that happened because it was an injury. I think bringing Roberts on for Dan James, and as you say, we haven't seen Roberts play as a wide player since the Championship days. There was a spell in Bielsa's first season when he played wide quite regularly, but we haven't really seen it since then. Was probably a bit of a strange substitution. I thought that was going to be the moment when he would have brought Somerville on if he was going to bring him on, and so that kind of sense that some of the thinking wasn't entirely logical probably compounded some of the live feelings about the game. But on the rewatch, I agree with you. I don't think it was as bad as I thought it was last night. As you alluded to earlier, I think my real frustration comes because from maybe 70 minutes, I thought Newcastle looked even worse in defensive transition than they were earlier in the game, and that there was space there to be exploited, and that if we'd have had the composure to pick the correct pass at various times, or to execute the pass properly, which I think was as much as a problem as anything else, and I think we would have been able to create more good chances in the last 20 minutes and eventually come to win the game. So I think that's really where my continued frustration comes from. How about you? So you've watched it, what, three times now or twice?
Just twice, yeah.
Yeah, So how did you see it, John?
Yeah, I think what's going on at the moment is that there's this sort of mythic idea of how we played last season. And what that is that, you know, it was those games where we did dominate possession to a certain extent. We were able to build up in those wide areas, as we've talked about a lot. And you know, we created goals that were maybe had a little bit more guile to them. But I think that overlooks the fact that there were a lot of games last season that were similar to this. And I think so much of this comes down to the fact that we are so dependent on the way that oppositions play, both stylistically and structurally, that sometimes we do have a game which is just a bit messy. And the difference between this game and other games last season is that we took our chances more last season. So, for example, I watched the Wolves game back from last season, the first Wolves game, because I was interested to see how Rodrigo would play in a 4-4-2. And that game was very similar to this game in a lot of respects, other than the fact that when Wolves went ahead and they had the ability to then sit back and cause problems in that structure in a way that I don't think Newcastle were able to. So, you know, there's a sense in which Newcastle didn't really sit back, because I think they realised that if they did sit back, they probably wouldn't hold on to a lead. So they just sort of carried on playing at a fairly high tempo. And so it ends up being a raggedy game. They're a team who aren't going to build up from the back, really. They're going to try and get forward directly and quickly, as quickly as possible too. And so I think as a result of that, you end up with these sorts of messy games where Leeds do create chances, and the difference between this season and last season is that for some reason at the moment our finishing is just a little bit slow. And I think when you then compound that with the games preceding that, the game last night, you then start sort of write it into this narrative that, oh well, you know, we're never gonna win again, or you know, we're looking poor in these certain areas. And I think it's just important to look back at maybe other games like that last season and remind ourselves that there were some games where we did look pretty raggedy, we did look pretty messy, and we didn't even manage to get the win against Wolves, but it came within the context of we were winning other games at the time, and so it wasn't quite so nervy as it maybe is at the moment.
Yeah, I agree with everything you've just said, but I've always kind of had this idea, and I don't know how true it is. It might just be because of certain games kind of giving me a perceived outcome bias, but that we have the potential to look really good against a passive mid-block, and that's how I saw Newcastle last night, is a very passive mid-block. And I think back to the Aston Villa game last season at Villa Park. They played in a very passive mid-block, and we were able to use the ball well, we were able to manoeuvre them around well, we were able to create good chances, and we were able to pick them off. And if you even think about it, to the extent that in that game Villa's only real threat came from Jack Grealish, and if you substitute that for last night for St Maximin, I think that actually those are two quite similar games, albeit they played in different formations and some of the tactics are slightly different. I'm not saying they're completely interchangeable, but that it was the sort of game where I would ordinarily have expected us to be able to kind of use the ball much more effectively than we did last night. I think that's the frustration for me.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily disagree with you, but I would say that Villa were bombing their fullbacks on, whereas yesterday Newcastle played it with a back five for long stretches. And again, we've talked at length about, you know, leaving Leeds space there. And I think what we're seeing this season is teams just unwilling to give Leeds space in behind the fullbacks in the wide areas. And so, yeah, with that caveat, I think, you know, Villa's the transitions against Villa were like a lot easier as well, weren't they? They were leaving us a lot of space in midfield. But I think that's another question for another podcast. So let's move on to the second question I have. So this week, Marcelo Bielsa said in press conferences, quote, "One path to follow is to go long and go for 50-50s. We're not going to do this. The other path, his path, is going from defence to attack, keeping the ball." How much evidence of this did you see last night, Darren?
I think this is a really, really difficult question, because I still think that clearly Bielsa's intention is for us to build up as we've done at the most successful periods of his spell. But I genuinely believe that what's happening is that the players are getting on the pitch and seeing that, maybe, you know, perhaps that the movement from midfield and the rotations aren't working as effectively as they once were, and they don't have the options, particularly from the fullback area, to kind of move the ball into the midfield and build up that way, and are just choosing, instead of keeping the ball and recycling it as we would have, you know, opportunities to do last night, are choosing to go long. I mean, if you look at in the first 60 seconds or first 80 seconds yesterday, we'd looked to ping the ball onto Dan James' head, and you know, Dan James is about 3'6". There's absolutely no way he's going to win those balls, but you know, we kind of, so I feel like that while the will may be there from Bielsa, and that his intention and his tactical plan is still for us to build up in the way that we have, that we're for whatever reason, I think we've alluded to some of the reasons that we're not able to build up, and that we haven't got the control of the ball in the midfield, that we haven't perhaps got the profile of player in the midfield area that we need. Because although Bielsa's midfield eights have always kind of got involved in the front line and have kind of bombed on, I think that it's definitely also true that when we've got the correct mixture and profiles of player in the midfield, that they are far more prepared to drop in, to pick up the ball from the fullbacks, to kind of, you know, kind of try and support the build-up in that way. If you think about the times when Pablo played as an eight, he was always prepared to drop deep and to support build-up play in that way. Forshaw is always prepared to build up play in that way. And at the moment, we just don't seem to have the players that are prepared to drop in. So therefore, the options that are available are knock the ball around the back five, or to try and be a bit more direct and transitional. And to try and, or even use Bamford as a kind of hold up, which we did a couple of times last night, but not particularly successfully. I think it is a difficult question to answer, because whilst Bielsa is saying these things, there's actually not a huge amount of evidence to support it in terms of what we're seeing on the pitch.
Yeah, interesting that you brought up the midfield situation, because we had a few questions actually about the midfield, namely about the fact that Leeds don't have players in midfield a lot of the time. And I thought, I did want to throw in maybe a listener question, but I found three other questions that I thought were maybe more apposite to discuss at the moment. But I think it's worth talking about, because I think, as you've said, when we go forward, because we use a form of positional play, the whole idea is that you get your two eights into that forward line, so that when we get the ball into the wide area and you play it into that corridor of uncertainty, you've got players attacking every one of the channels between the opposition defenders. That's all well and good. And the reason why we struggle in defensive transition is the same reason why Manchester City struggle in defensive transition, because they're doing the same thing. They're trying to get their players in dangerous positions, and then you try and mitigate the consequences of that in those defensive transitional moments. And that's why it's important to have someone like Calvin Phillips in your team, because he's a really good defensive transitional player. But I think the problem is then is that, so you've got there's two issues here. What are the midfielders doing that actually helps us control the game? And I think one of those things is in possession, like in more patient possession, it's doing precisely what we talked about before, which is helping the build up in wide areas. So we've seen Mateusz Klich can do that really well. Adam Forshaw is very good at that as well. It just helping the ball into those wide areas where our players can then get the ball into those dangerous spaces. So in some senses, I kind of feel as though people complain about the fact we have huge spaces in our midfield, when I think that's a tactical decision and that's fine. But the issue for me is with the midfield personnel that we have is that we maybe don't have enough players who can actually help us control the ball in the wide areas to make those attacking choices worthwhile.
Yeah, I agree. When it works well, and again, I come back to when Pablo's played there or when Forshaw's played there, what they do really well is they drop into the half spaces in our half and support the build-up there. And at the moment, nobody's doing that. And maybe Klich was doing it a couple of times last night. Maybe I'm being slightly unfair. But because we were playing effectively a 4-4-2 last night too, I suppose that made it even more challenging in a sense, because that's not really Calvin's game to get into that space and support that kind of build-up. He's always more likely to look to go more direct and to move the ball on more quickly, or to recycle the ball out to the full-back with slightly longer passes. So yeah, I agree. It's a real challenge and a real quandary for how we go forward from here. Because one of the advantages of our system is that as soon as we get the ball, we make the pitch enormous, don't we? We kind of really spread out wide and we spread up high and we really try and stretch the opposition. But the result of losing the ball in those situations is dire. And at the moment, we are losing the ball in transition so often that we're just asking for trouble all the time. And I'd be kind of really an advocate for a much more patient approach. And maybe that involves putting, you know, because I think Shackleton can do it. I think he can do that kind of build-up. So maybe it involves putting Shackleton in, or somebody like that, who can just give us that little bit more control, whose decision-making around when to bomb and when to pass and when to sit in is a bit better. I just don't know how we get out of it.
We did have a question from Adam Michael Finney, which, again, is another question that didn't make the final cut, but I did want to talk about it. But he talked a lot about recovery speed in terms of, as you're talking about there, the ability to sort of track back in those moments where we are defending backwards. And I think the idea of playing Jamie Shackleton for me over someone like Stuart Dallas is I think plausible, given that at the moment we are doing a lot of defensive transitional work, and I think I would just prefer to have players like Shaq in the team, who you know is a very dynamic player who is going to not only get forward at pace and in exciting ways, but is also going to get back and cover that ground. Adam Michael Finney was just comparing this team with Chelsea's best teams, the Chilean and Athletic Club teams, where he was saying that he remembered that it just felt like, and we saw it in the Championship as well, didn't we? When we would lose the ball and everyone would get back quickly, we just don't see that happening as much now.
Yeah, there's that really famous clip, isn't there, of I think it was away at Wigan, where we lose the ball on the edge of our box and there are seven or eight players, every single one of them absolutely determined to get into position to get the ball. And yeah, you're right, that exact clip came across my mind last night when I think Newcastle had an attacking transition, and it wasn't through St Maximin, it was somebody else, maybe Willock or somebody. And it looked like, you know, that the players were kind of getting back in pairs rather than kind of all absolutely bombing back together. So yeah, I think there are questions to be asked there about why that's happening.
Yeah, and I think we've got a question later on that does address that, so I'll leave that now. One final thing just on Calvin Phillips' thing in the midfield. One thing I've started seeing, particularly in the last couple of games, is Phillips dropping out. So we talk a lot about the salida, the exit that they use in South American football, the term that they use for the sort of build-up from the back, and one of the famous ideas about the salida is called the salida la Volpiana, which is a very specific it references I can't remember where the coach is from, but one of the South American coaches who is the guy who advocated the centre midfielder dropping in between the centre backs in a back four. And what we're seeing a lot actually at the moment is Phillips doing that but dropping into the full back areas, particularly behind Junior. So it looks as though that we are trying, well, Bielsa is trying to think of ways that we can get e.g. Junior further forward a lot more with Phillips covering behind him as well. But again, that means that in those transitional moments, we don't even have Phillips in the centre. He has to run into the central space to sort of cover that area as well. So that I can see why people are concerned about those the central areas. But I do think that that's a tactical decision. And Bielsa's argument will be, well, once we start controlling the ball a little bit more, we won't have to worry about those so much. So
yeah, I think one of the problems, just the last thing on this, one of the problems with this playing something looks more like a 4-4-2 as well, as it does tend to suck Phillips out of, even when we're going forward, it tends to suck Phillips further forward than we would ideally like, which even again creates more space in that area.
So question number three, I posted a Twitter thread on Thursday saying that I thought that the 4-4-2 against teams who aren't going to be building up from the back is probably the best system for Rodrigo to play in. Do you think the game bore this out?
Yeah, I do. I thought Rodrigo was good last night. I thought he was able to kind of use, you know, the skills that we know he's got, which is his intelligent use of space, his kind of surprise. He uses the ball in quite surprising ways sometimes, which I think is really good for, you know, taking the opposition out of their stride. I think the kind of downside of that is that sometimes it's to surprise our players too and doesn't really make anything of it. But I thought his movement was good. I thought his use of the ball was quite intelligent. I thought he looked creative. I thought he looked lively around their box. I thought he was quite unlucky with a couple of situations. I think I agree. I think that if we're going to see, you know, an idealised use of Rodrigo, it would be in a system where he's playing as the second striker, where his defensive responsibilities are quite limited, and where he's able to kind of exploit the spaces that are available to him.
Yeah, and just looking at FB Ref, he picked up 0.8 expected assists yesterday. I think he was an important attacking player. And let's be clear, like we have been critical of Rodrigo on this channel, but we've always been critical of him in the context of the impact that he has on the press. And I think in a game like yesterday's game, those sort of pressing moments aren't quite so important. Like we said, Newcastle aren't trying to build up from the back. Largely, their goal kicks are going long. It doesn't really matter so much what he's doing defensively. And as we've said, he can sort of drop from that second striker position in front of the two eights and almost play as a second striker and find that space and play players in from there. So I do think that this is the ideal system for him against the ideal team in that system. So good to see him you know, putting up good numbers in that position. I guess the wider question is, as we always suggest, like, what about the other games where we struggle to get him in the team and the system doesn't really work around him? But we've talked about that at length, so I'm sure we don't need to cover that again. Do you have any final thoughts on Rodrigo?
Yeah, just one final thing really is that in the games where he's played in the midfield so far this season, when he has dropped into the midfield area with his back to the opposition goal, he has struggled in terms of supporting the build-up. And because he wasn't required to do that yesterday, it just meant that he could quite often get the ball in areas where he was more comfortable, where he was facing their goal and where he could see the movements going off around him that he could try pick out.
Yeah, totally agree. Right, question four. There was a lot of dissatisfaction with Junior amongst some of the fans last night. Do you think that's fair on the basis of his performance?
Not at all. I'm not going to say that anybody had a great game last night, because I just don't think that's true. But at the same time, I thought Junior was decent. I think he was largely marking Almiron, if I'm right in thinking that. And he seemed to manage that well. I think a lot of the criticism is coming from a perceived idea that he should be the one backing up Liam Cooper when Saint-Maximin is running at him. And that just, I think, shows a fundamental misunderstanding of our marking system. The left fullback who's got his own marking assignment isn't going to drop himself spare to support Cooper in that situation. It's going to be the other centre back, and by and large we saw that happening. So I thought defensively he's never going to be amazing defensively, is he? There are always going to be times when he gets bypassed a bit too easily, when he tries to jump in too quickly and gets taken out of the game, but I think we knew that about him before he came, so I don't think anything that I've seen of him defensively has been a massive surprise to me. I think that in terms of his ability to support our build up he's a massive upgrade on Alioski, and I think there is a bit of revisionism going on about Alioski at the moment, because we look like we're struggling, that suddenly, you know, he's kind of this world beater left back, when we all know that isn't the case. I think Firpo looks after the ball much better than Alioski did. I think he makes some really smart runs, late inverted runs into the box, which at the moment we're not picking out. But I think over the course of the season, we will pick those out more regularly, and he might come up with a couple of assists or goals from that situation. I would like to see situations whereby he can overlap and bomb on that way a little bit more, but I think Dan James, by and large, stayed very high and wide yesterday, so it wasn't really going to create a situation where Firpo could do that. But I thought he was all right. I thought he was fine yesterday. What do you think, John?
It's tough to judge players individually because they are playing in systems. And I think it's fair to say to Junior that the assumption is being made that because Junior is maybe looking a little bit underwhelming at times compared to what you might expect for a, you know, 15 million euro player from Barcelona to be, there's this sort of expectation that he should be carrying the level of the team up, perhaps. And I guess I would try to deflate that and invert it and say the team aren't playing well at the moment, and so it means that we're not seeing the sorts of things that we think Junior can do well as much. I do share the concern that people have about him, like, not getting forward as much, because he does seem quite circumspect in some situations to go forward. Now, we know that that's because, actually, you know, tracking back, he can often look a little bit shaky. So I think he's nervous going forward because he realizes that the correlation of that is that he will have to come back. But yesterday, I thought the chance before half time, which was, I think, maybe the best chance that we created last night, where he ran into space in the wing, clipped the ball into Rafinha at the back post, and Rafinha was just too slow getting it going. I feel like that was potentially like one of our most threatening moments in the game, and that was because of him, and that was because he played that ball in. I don't think you would probably get that from Alioski. Alioski was great at bombing on. He had a lot of energy, but he was playing for our team at a point when, you know, everything was going well for the team. And I think it's easy to forget some of those games where we looked awful in possession because Alioski was just losing the ball left, right, centre, or, you know, volleying passes back to Melier at about 60 feet in the air, back passes, which wasn't the most ideal use of the possession for me, but maybe I'm old-fashioned. So I think this is one of those things where Junior is, he does have an upside, but it does seem as though he's balancing that upside with a level of circumspectness about getting forward and being a little bit more careful out of possession. And I think so much of that comes down to the fact that we are not as good in possession this season. Whether or not, again, like, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Are we looking less good in possession because he's not getting into the right positions? I think that's maybe a little bit of an unfair reading of it. But I also do feel as though we're not doing the best to get the best out of him as a team. And I think that's the best way of judging him on that.
Yeah, agreed.
Right, one final question, and another a player. Unfortunately, there wasn't a huge amount of tactical stuff to get our teeth into, so I've had to talk a little bit about individuals, which I don't really like doing necessarily. But it's perhaps unfair to judge Dan James after so few minutes and the context that he made his debut in a team down to 10 men against Liverpool. But what have you made of Dan James at this point?
I find it difficult to draw any sort of conclusion about him at this point, really. I suppose framing the question in terms of, is he doing what he's been asked to do, would be reasonable. And I don't think yesterday was the sort of game that was ever going to suit him, because I think he's only going to really thrive in games where there's a lot of space in behind that he can run into. And there just wasn't really that last night. Or on the occasions we didn't have good enough control of the ball to put him in there. I don't think he's ever going to be somebody who's going to unpick a defence with an individual piece of skill or a bit of flair or something like that, where he creates a bit of space for himself. It's all going to be about being explosive. I think he's got a reasonably good first touch and he's able to lay the ball off quickly and then make a good run. And I think that might be sometimes where we might see his upside. But again, I don't think we really saw that happening yesterday. I thought he just really, really struggled to get into the game in any meaningful way at all. A lot of the balls that were looking for him were high balls that had been pinged to him from our kind of back third or from the middle third. And I just don't see how he's really going to have any meaningful influence if that's how we're going to use him. He should have had a penalty, but, you know, we're talking about referees is really boring, so I'm not really going to get into that. I think he should have had a penalty, but whatever. But beyond that, I just thought he was a non-factor in the game, both in an attacking and a defensive point of view, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm just looking at, again, FBref, and he had 11 yards of progressive carries and 22 yards of progressive passing. That's not good enough for a winger in our system. The argument has been and will be that Bielsa sees something in him that he likes, and therefore we just have to wait and see where that comes, what that looks like. But like you said, it seems to me the only upside you're going to get from him is he's not a good dribbler. He's good at carrying the ball at speed, like you said. So you're looking at getting him in behind and scoring goals that way. But beyond that, like, there's a lot more scope to the wide players that we have in our system than that. And I guess I'm not seeing any clear examples that he's going to be good at that at this point. So that's the worrying thing about Dan James, is that if you have a player who's very specific, and is very specifically good at one thing, the worry is that if they're not being able to do that, then what upside are you getting from them? And that's kind of where I'm at with him at the moment.
Yeah, I agree.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So enough of my interrogation of you, Darren. Now time for you to, I guess, interrogate me back. So this is the bring a topic section. So what topic did you want to bring to the discussion today?
Yeah, obviously Alan St-Maximin was their only attacking threat. They didn't look like they were going to create chances at all unless he was involved heavily in the play. And I saw a lot of people really heavily criticising Liam Cooper for his performance yesterday. But I just thought it'd be interesting to ask whether you thought we managed him, whether we managed St Maximin well, poorly or indifferently. So what are your thoughts?
Far be it from me to jump into the FB ref again, but just looking at his underlying numbers, 0.2 XG, 0.3 expected assists, I'd say that's managing a player pretty well, managing the opposition's best player well as well. We know what Alan St Maximin is good at, and it is running with the ball, and no surprises that the goal he scored came from, you know, sending a few of our players for donuts, and just sort of moving the ball around and creating space and getting the shot away. In that situation, like, yeah, okay, look, it wasn't the best chance ever, I didn't think, insofar as, like, if you look at his numbers for expected goals, he had 5 shots and put up, as I've said, 0.2 XG. Like, he's not creating anything near big chances. You're going to allow a player of his quality to create an outside chance, and a player of his quality will take an outside chance every now and again. So I think the fact that he scored shouldn't really come into it in that respect. And I felt as though largely Cooper covered him pretty well. And I said that as someone who's nervous about Liam Cooper when players of St Maximin's ability are running at him. So I felt pretty comfortable with the defensive job that was done. I suppose there was that big chance that came at the back post. I think, was it Joe Willock who had it, where the ball was laid off by St Maximin just gaining wide. Again, you know, he gets around the side of Cooper, but like, we're talking about situations where a player of that quality is going to cause problems, and the question isn't can you completely stop this guy from having chances or creating chances, can you make those things as difficult for him to do as possible and try and stifle them in that way. And I think largely Cooper did that as well. So what about you? What did you make of it?
Yeah, I broadly agree. I thought Cooper managed him more effectively in the second half than he did in the first. I thought there were a couple of moments in the first half where he just kind of got really sucked in and made St Maximin's decision for him by, yeah, kind of showing him the space to run into, and I thought that was a bit of a problem. But I do think that even in the second half, the good defensive tackles that Cooper did were tackles that were right on the edge, where if he misses them, you know that Cooper's in. But that is just a hallmark of our defensive style, isn't it? Everything that we do is right on the edge anyway, so I don't necessarily see that as a criticism of Cooper. It's just the structures in which he is expected to perform. I thought by and large Aileen did back Cooper up pretty well in terms of managing St Maximin, and I thought there were a couple of times when that worked really well. I just think in a game against a player whose entire game is based in those individual moments where he's going to try run at people and beat them, that they are the most difficult players to manage out of any individual. So I think that, yeah, I thought overall we did okay. I mean, the moments are terrifying. It's terrifying when he picks up the ball and runs at your back four, and it looks bad when he's doing that. But actually, the outcome was more often than not reasonably good because I thought Cooper defended him pretty well.
With Newcastle, their game plan going forward is going to be try and find him on the ball, and I think in those circumstances, it's not too bad when you've got a man marker and a player over to sort of cover a player like that. I think I kind of feel not too worried about it. I think we've seen it in other players as well. Maybe Alexander Mitrovic, when we were in the Championship, played against them. I felt similarly with that. You know, here's a player who the majority of their game plan revolves around, but we can effectively have two players covering him the whole time. And I feel as though I generally feel quite safe in those situations. Obviously, as I've said, it's not about completely stopping. I mean, ideally, it is about completely stopping them, but I don't think you beat yourself up when you allow them a few chances. It's just about mitigating those chances and trying to make them as low quality as possible. And I think largely that happened yesterday. enough of us. Let's move over to the listener questions. So, yeah, hundreds of questions, actually. A lot of people wanted to talk last night after the game, which I suppose is a good sign. But let's just crack through these questions. So the first question is from Jamie, who says, people always say a team's been figured out when they have a poor second season. But do you think our performances are more down to the way opposition teams have set up against us, or our own inadequacies, or a bit of both? So what do you make of that, Darren?
Yeah, a bit of both. I would say that it's more to do with, as we've alluded to many times on this podcast, that the way that opposition and just not leaving space in for our wingers to make hay in, and I think that is a big factor, and that's been a big factor in all of the games. I do think that the other four teams, I mean, in fact, let's just take Man United and Liverpool out of the equation for a second, because I just don't think it's really relevant to talk about those two teams here. But I think both Everton and Burnley were much more proactive in terms of the way that they tried to defend us than Newcastle were. And I think in both of those games, their tactical game plans were probably the defining factor and has been unable to create a lot of good chances. Yesterday, I think, was different, as I've already said. I think we made quite a few chances, and also we did let a lot of opportunities, particularly late in the game, go to make better ones than we did. So I think that specifically yesterday, it was a combination of them, yeah, leaving their fullbacks deep, but also our inability to make the best of the situations that we put ourselves in.
Yeah, I totally agree with you here. I think it's important to try and narrate this, because the narrative is going to be that, oh, you know, we're playing badly at the moment, therefore if we don't get a result, then it's been a bad performance. I actually think yesterday's performance was fine. I think we did enough to win. I think, yes, there are frustrations with some of the ways that we're playing, but, like, you know, a win is a win, and I think there's enough teams in the division that if you can pull off those wins in that manner, as we did yesterday, that you're going to be fine in the long run. There's, you know, we had an equally scrappy win at St James's Park last time round. Was that at the Elland Road? I can't remember which word it was. The St James's Park, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Where we were quite lucky. I think we put up 0.5 XG and we ended up scoring two goals. And we spent, I think, a big portion of the end of that game sort of digging in a little bit, holding on to our lead. So the idea that we sort of played free flowing football last season the whole time, I just don't think is right. And yes, okay, the worry is that we're not getting results where we maybe deserve to get results. That's definitely an issue. But, you know, I am a firm believer that, you know, a form is something which happens in sort of smaller blocks than a whole season. So, yeah, OK, maybe our finishing is going to be fairly poor at times. But I also think that we'll have times when our finishing is good. And let's face it, like, we were quite clinical with our finishing against Everton and Burnley from the chances that we created, I thought. So, yeah, it goes both ways. But I do think this was a good performance. I don't like games like this because they're too messy. They are going to be open. They are going to be scrappy games. And it does come down to, like, how good is your finishing in those games. We created decent chances. I don't think we created any, like, really good chances insofar as, like, you know, getting in behind their defence, having a one-on-one with the keeper or anything like that. But we created, according to StatsBomb, 2.2 XG. So to only score one goal from that, you might feel a little bit aggrieved. But I do think that we are figured out, in the sense that managers who are tactically astute will know how to make things difficult for us. We saw it with Graham Potter last season. We've seen it with, I think, both Sean Dyche and Rafa Benitez this season. And that's kind of the worry, is that, like, if you're okay, if you're getting figured out by the teams in the mid-table, you're maybe dropping a few points there. And then if you're not taking your chances against, like, relegation battlers, you're not getting points there either. That's kind of the worry here. But I kind of feel as though we've got enough to stay up, and a lot of the pain that we're experiencing as fans right now is having to reassess the fact that we're not actually as good as we thought we were last season. And that's a difficult process to go through. But yeah, I think we'll stay up. I still think we'll stay up. I know that there's a lot of people talking about Sheffield United and second season syndrome. I do think we've got enough to actually turn some of these teams over with a bit of luck. And yeah, I'm sure that we'll start seeing that.
I agree, for what it's worth.
So, second question is from Mark Forsyth, who says, Do the stats show any differences in our passing completion this season compared to the same period last season? We just seem to be way more sloppy than we were. And I've included this one because we've actually been asked about pass completion quite a bit. So I thought it would be important to just have a conversation about that. But yeah, I just wondered what you made of this question in terms of pass completion rates.
My impression, and when we looked at pass completion rates last season, is that they were not as high as we probably anticipated that they would be anyway, because I think our style intrinsically lends itself to a high number of turnovers per game. The thing which sways people's opinions about that is whether we make good chances and whether we score. And in the moments where it doesn't work, we give the ball away a lot. And even when it, so say if in a game you make five or six good chances in the game and score two of those, there are still going to be dozens of times when we've given the ball away sloppily, trying to either overstretch ourselves or trying to speculate a pass or something like that. So I haven't actually looked at the figures for this, John, but I can just see you typing into FBref now.
I always love things like this because inevitably they like blow people's minds. But yeah, our passing completion rate is higher this season than it was last season. Now, obviously, like, it's a much smaller sample size this season, so you're going to expect that, I think. But our average pass completion rate last season was 79.8%, and we're up at 82.2% this season. I think there's a number of reasons for this. One of them is that I guess if you consider football in terms of transitions, so or possession like moments, so you have the ball and then you turnovers is probably the best way of thinking about it. So let's say that Leeds are putting up the same amount of turnovers in a game as usual, then their pass completion rate is going to be the same, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that the volume of passes is the same. So you could have a team like Leeds maybe doing huge amounts of passing at the back because they can't work it forward, in which case they're going to have decent pass completion numbers. And then last season, say our build-up was really good, that we got into those wide areas, we then have players in attacking positions who play creative and dangerous chances that just don't find targets, and then your pass completion rate drops. So I think there's a sense in which there's a reality there that Leeds can get their players into more dangerous areas when they're building up well, and that will mean that their pass completion rate is probably a little bit lower because they are able to make those more dangerous passes. So the problem is that people see us losing the ball a lot in poor positions, and that's definitely happening. But if you compare that with last season, the balls were being lost in much more promising, dangerous positions. So you're losing the same amount of passes, or slightly fewer. But that's because the reason it feels so bad is because you're only focusing on the position of those where those passes are being lost. So Luke Ayling has been losing the ball in horrendous positions this season. But like in previous seasons, that ball would have progressed all the way down the season, down the pitch, and Rafinha would have lost it, right? So your pass completion rate is exactly the same, give or take, because you're still losing that pass further down the field, and it just shows up differently in the data. So
yeah, and when we've had settled possession this season so far, it's been with the centre backs knocking it back and forth to each other and knocking it to Melier. And so if you look at Pascal Strauch or Liam Cooper's pass completion rate for short or medium range passes for the season so far, it'll be close to 100%, I'm certain. And in fact, I looked at Pascal's last week for the article we did, and it was about 100% on all of those, maybe dropping to 95% occasionally. I do think that yesterday, once we'd scored, there might have been an argument for us actually doing some more of that kind of easy possession at the back to try and draw Newcastle out a little bit, instead of just kind of going for the jugular every single time we get the ball, because I think that we would therefore have been able to exploit spaces that they were definitely leaving much more easily. So I think there's a kind of decision making element as a team there in terms of when we choose to kind of bomb forward and when we choose to kind of take the sting out of the game, if you like, and we just don't seem able to manage the game in that way at the moment at all.
Final question from Jackie Buckets. He says, "I feel like a conspiracy theorist, but are we reaching the end of the cycle with Bielsa?" So we've been pretty positive in this episode, I think, but I do think this is an interesting question and one that does need addressing in some sense. But so what's your take on this, Dan?
My sense is that some of the players are probably near the end of their cycle, and that the answer to this question will come in Bielsa's decision as to whether he's prepared to renew the squad or not over a period of time, because if he's not prepared to do that and we continue playing players who've worked wonders for us, who I'm very affectionate about, who've you know, kind of got, you know, the promotion team and all the rest of it. I'm not, I don't want this to sound like I'm digging players out and saying, kind of slagging them off, but it seems clear to me that some of the players that we've got in our squad are probably nearer to the end of their cycle than others, and that we need to renew the squad and improve the quality of the squad in certain areas of the team. And if Bielsa isn't prepared to do that, then he's going to naturally bring about the end of his own cycle. And I suppose what I would say is that the indicators for that so far this season, and it is only 5 games, it is a small sample size, but the indicators don't look good right now at this moment in time. So I'm not kind of saying, yeah, we're definitely at the end of Bielsa's cycle, because I think that would be a ridiculous thing to say after 5 games, but I do think there are some worrying indicators.
Totally agree that this is all about the squad cycle, and I think the idea that you can play 3 seasons of Bielsa ball and then not suffer the effects of that, I think, is naive. And I think that's why so many of us were frustrated about the window that we just had. Not least because I think even if you're not at that point in the cycle, it doesn't look like particularly good planning for the future. But I think when you add into that equation the fact that playing intense football for that amount of time through a pandemic and through various scheduling issues that we've had as a result of that, it's pretty mad. And I think we're starting to see that with Luke Ayling, potentially with Stuart Dallas. Again, we know that they both had sort of poor runs of form, but with Ayling, it does seem to be a little bit more endemic than that. And I guess we wait and see this space. But the idea for me is that I actually think that my hot take on Bielsa is that the reason why we've never really seen Bielsa burn out is because we've never actually seen him at a club long enough to actually experience what that looks like. And I think the burnout to a certain extent is inevitable with any club and with any manager. Like, they talk about cycles of 3 years, but I just think that's exacerbated by the intensity that Bielsa wants his team to play at. And then when you add into the fact that when it comes to recruitment, he seems to have an inability to realise that you can't just play the same team forever. And I think that all just sort of adds to a bit of a cocktail of chaos and I guess lack of planning. So I suspect we may be coming to the end of certainly this squad cycle. And I think what's going to be fascinating about this season is we've never had the chance to see Bielsa run a squad into the ground before, because he's only been at a place for 2 seasons before this. And so we may be able to see that in real time. But that's a very pessimistic view, and hopefully it won't come to that. And like I say, I think we're good enough to be able to stay up. But I think next summer is going to be a nightmare to rebuild this squad.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, like you mentioned Luke Ayling and Stuart Dallas already as players who maybe, you know, are the ones coming to the end of their cycle. And obviously Mattias Glick has had a really difficult season last season, and we're hoping that he can renew and get back to where he was at some point. But he's actually the oldest player out of that group, and it's going to be interesting to see just how much he can contribute over the course of the season. I hope it's a lot, obviously, but I think we are in desperate need of kind of making the decision or making the plans for how we move those players out of the squad over the next couple of years, for sure. Over the next year, perhaps.
Do Star Trek Bamford. Yeah, it's that time of the show when we talk about stats and get to sing the Patrick Bamford song, but with the name replaced. Again, tricky game to sort of get anything out of in terms of the numbers. I thought it would be good to talk about XG versus post-shot XG, which is something we've talked about before. Now, I think by now most of our listeners will know what expected goals is. Expected goals is a way of measuring the quality of chances as you create them. So rather than just saying we had 10 chances, you start looking at how likely those chances were to go in, and then you can build a better picture perhaps of how likely a team were to score. Now, post-shot XG does exactly what it says on the tin insofar as it looks at the likelihood of scoring after the shot has been taken. So XG looks at that before doesn't really take the shot into account at all. It just looks at what the location and various other variables and makes the assessment based on that. But post-shot XG now takes into account the trajectory and the speed of the ball towards the goal. So if you take a shot with a low expected goal score, and you leather it towards the top corner. So if you have a, I guess the Rafinha goal yesterday is actually quite a good example of this. That's a very low likelihood of going in because he basically crossed the ball towards Rodrigo. So you look at that, and the XG for that would be very low. But I think if you looked at the post-shot XG, so once the ball's left his foot, you can see that it is heading towards the goal. It's obviously a slow ball, and the keeper would usually save it. So I don't think that you would necessarily raise the quality of... That would raise the quality of the chance. But obviously, if it's going straight towards the keeper, it's even less likely to go in. So the post-shot XG is basically just a way of showing that that you raise the likelihood of scoring by taking a good shot. So if your finishing is good, your post-shot XG will be good. So yesterday, StatsBomb had the XG down as 1.3 to Newcastle to 2.2 to Leeds. I'd done a thread on the Twitter channel just looking at some of the chances and assessing this. So do head over there because the Opta figures were a little bit lower for this one. But we usually take StatsBomb as the market leader on in terms of their model and the values that they put out. So that's the XG. The post-shot XG, though, per StatsBomb was 1.5 to 1.5, which obviously looks a lot more equal than 1.3 to 2.2. Now, the way that you read that is that Newcastle slightly increased the quality of their chances by shooting, whereas Leeds reduced the quality of their chances by shooting quite a bit, by, what is it, 0.7 XG. So nearly a full goal. We were less likely to score by a full goal after shooting. So I'm going to just put a caveat here about the StatsBomb model, because the StatsBomb model doesn't take into account keeper positioning, I believe. So the argument that they would have is it's a good way of looking at how well a keeper is doing, because it just sort of assumes the keeper's in the middle and is going to try and save shots with that in mind. So the you shouldn't read too much into a post shot XG model from StatsBomb from the point of view of the people taking the shots. But in general, I think the idea is that if you're taking shots that are heading quickly towards the top corners or bottom corners, wide of the keeper, you're more likely to score than if you hit it straight at it. So I do think there's something indicative here that Leeds weren't making the most of their chances. So Darren, what do you make of this, and how much of this game yesterday was just about finishing and the fact that Leeds didn't seem able to do it as well as Newcastle were?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some truth in that. I don't think Newcastle's finishing was extraordinary either. I think most of the increase in their XG when it goes to post shot is probably from that one chance where St Maximin hit a ball really hard and low towards our right-hand corner and Melier got across and saved it. I think that would be probably the only one where I would imagine that increased their XG. I think from our point of view, you can think of the junior Firpo chance, you can think of the Rodrigo chance where Dan James led the ball back to him and he tried to roll it into the bottom corner, which I think was a really, really good chance and I would have expected him to take it. But I think, yeah, overall, you know, the few biggish chances that we got, we really didn't make the most of. And also, I think we've kind of established this morning that some of the... that two of Bamford's chances, or certainly Bamford's XG, has been overrated across the game, because I think all the chances that he got were actually much more difficult than the kind of narrative is saying. So it does seem that we missed some good chances and maybe didn't have the composure or the quality to take the ones. I think it tells the story of what I saw, I think.
Yeah, no, agreed. I think the Bamford header, in inverted commas, at 19 minutes is probably where a lot of that comes from. So the big question is, how good a chance was that? And I think the reason why... It's interesting that the post-shot XG from StatsBomb is much more similar to the Opta numbers that we're seeing from various outlets, which had it, I think, more like 1.3 to Newcastle to 1.5 to Leeds. And I think a lot of it hinges on how much value is being given to that Patrick Bamford header. Now, on the one hand, the Opta data is obviously wrong, because if you look, you can look on the shot map for understand, and you can look on the shot map for infogoal, and it's clear that they've just mispositioned where the header was taken. But at the same time, I think when you look at the StatsBomb value that they've probably put on that, we don't have the individual value for that chance. But it looks like a lot of the value is coming from that chance. And I think that's because it's a header like right on the edge of the 6-yard box, and it's fairly uncontested. But if you actually watch the clip, Bamford misreads the flight of the ball and ends up facing the wrong way and sort of can only manage to get his back on it. And I think that's where a lot of that post-shot XG gap is probably coming from as well. I think that the fact that he had like what I think their model would see as a good chance, but then just sort of dollied it towards the keeper very slowly, will mean that the post-shot XG was much lower. And so it's interesting for me that chance has been basically seems to be a lot of what's been downgraded. I mean, I think our finishing elsewhere was poor, as you've said. There are other examples of that, but I think some of it comes down to that as well. We're in need of positives, aren't we? So let's just quickly go through the positives. It will come as no surprise to anyone that Darren has selected Melier, as he does every week. I don't think he even bothers changing the running order. He just keeps it on there. But have you got any other positives for us, Darren?
Well, as I said in the running order, John, if someone else had played well, I wouldn't have to choose Melier every week, would I? I'm going to choose Rodrigo, actually, because I do think he did really well. I think it was a game that suited him. And sometimes when we've had games that we thought were going to suit him, he hasn't played well in them. And I think he did play well yesterday. And I also do think that it's really his influence on the goal has not been mentioned really. Because his run across the box and his decision to leave the ball is what allows the ball to go into the far corner past the keeper. I think if he may have got a touch on it and it may have gone in and it may not, but I think he really wrong foots the keeper by making that run. And I think it's really important to mention that. So I really hope that we have more games where we can play with two up front so that it can look good again. So yeah, Rodrigo did well.
I'm just going to add that we are creating chances against bad teams, which I think we went into this game suggesting that, you know, it would be fine if we had... I guess people came into this game saying it would be fine if we had a good performance and lost or didn't win. And I feel as though this was largely a good performance apart from finishing. I don't know whether or not you can necessarily complain about a result if we have created the chances that we needed to win. Like, I do think that there are issues, and I'm not trying to completely exonerate everything that happened yesterday, but I do think there's an alternative universe where, well, I mean, clearly there is, because XG is basically a probabilistic model. So if you played that game an infinite number of times, Leeds would score 2.2 goals and Newcastle would only score 1.3, which means that in the majority of the time, Leeds would be winning that game on the basis of the chances that they created. So I will say that I do think it was a positive performance in some respects, maybe not some of the stuff that we wanted to see. But as I've tried to make clear in this podcast, I think Newcastle aren't the sort of team that we should be trying to develop the sort of play style that we want to see as well. Right, let's just do quickly a bit of a game preview for the next game. I should say before this, we are playing Fulham on Tuesday, I believe. And I have spoken to Jack J. Collins of Fulhamish and Ranks FC. I've spent 30 minutes just chatting to him just about where Fulham are at this season, because obviously we don't know much about them as per previous seasons. And that will be coming out on this feed, so you will be able to listen to that on Monday morning. So that will give you something to look forward to. But we're going to preview the West Ham game, which is next weekend. West Ham, so far, have won 2, drawn 2. Some interesting results in there, because they've beaten Newcastle and Leicester, which is maybe a bit of an outlier, but then they've drawn with Crystal Palace and Southampton, which I don't think many people would have expected as well. So there is also the caveat that they're playing Europa League at the moment as well, so I wonder whether or not that plays into it somewhat. They did beat Dinamo Zagreb 2-0 in the midweek, so there's that to take into account as well. So they have got a fixture pile up a bit, given that they've gone straight from Europa League into the Carabao Cup as well. I think they're playing Manchester United this weekend, and they're also playing Manchester United in the Carabao Cup, so two toughish fixtures there for them as well. So my question to kick things off, just in terms of preview, is that West Ham, obviously one of the few teams to beat us twice last season, and it feels as though they were perhaps the beneficiaries of some of the weirdnesses of last season. So, you know, they're a solid team who creates through set pieces, which you're going to talk about a little bit, I think, Darren. But I'm interested in like your assessment of where they're at. Do we expect them to do as well this season, or did they get away with just sort of being a very solid side who create through set pieces? But how much do you think that is actually influencing our view of where they're at? And do you think that changes how we might view them this season?
I think with a reasonable playing staff, which Moyes has got down there, and a playing staff that's going to suit his style, I think they'll always achieve a kind of reasonable baseline performance, which sits somewhere between, you know, I'm just going to use the table as the indicator, really, somewhere between like 11th and, I don't know, 6th or something. They're always going to be in that range. And I really don't expect much variance from that. I expect them to be broadly similar to where they were last season, and they'll defend as effectively as they did last year. They'll create the same sort of chances they made last year, and whether they go in or not will be the thing which decides where they finish. So I don't expect a tremendous amount of variance in terms of playing style or in terms of the number of chances they create or in terms of how they create those chances. That's kind of my reading of them, John. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think I agree with that. I think that you talked about there them finishing between 11th and 6th, and I think you said no variance, but I actually think like the variance is that they'll hit sort of a baseline where they'll probably be like around the 7th, 8th best team in the division, and they'll variance up and down depending on, like you said, the finishing, whether or not that goes in. Just looking at the way that they set up, they've played in 4-2-3-1 all season this season. That's what they did most of last season as well, with their double pivots of Declan Rice and Thomas Suchek, both of whom we've come to know what to expect. Obviously a very sort of defensive attitude that they sort of sit deep. They allow themselves to have I guess the possibility of scoring a goal from a set piece and defending that lead. 4-2-3-1, I think, is a structure that suits us. We know that against 4-2-3-1, we can play a 4-1-4-1, which is, I think, our best system. So I think for you, Darren, this then just comes down to the question of like set pieces, right?
Well, yeah, the question that I've got, and I'm sure it won't be any surprise to anybody, is how do we construct a defence that can manage their set pieces, given that they scored from 4 against us last season, albeit one of them was a penalty. We always say, you know, our old friend, the set piece narrative, might come back in next week, but we always say, or I always say, that when we come up against teams who've got great delivery from set pieces or good movement or both, then we're really going to struggle. And I think West Ham demonstrated last season that they did have those. But you add into that we don't have Pascal Strauch or Llorente or Koch or Ayling available to us next week. And I think we're looking very, very, very thin on the ground for players who can manage West Ham's aerial set piece threat, with really only Liam Cooper, potentially Charlie Cresswell if he's brought in. I think Phillips is reasonably in the air for his size, but his size is a limiting factor. Obviously, we'll stick Bamford on the front post and Rafinha not far away from him to try and generate those breaks. But I suspect that very much there's going to be they're going to create chances from set pieces next week, and it'll be down to whether we get lucky or not as to whether we concede from them.
We will be talking at length about West Ham, if I can find someone who wants to talk to me about West Ham in the next few days. But that will be up on our Patreon. We'll have a full preview of that game. As I've mentioned, the Fulham preview will be out on Monday on the Free-to-Air channel. So if you're listening to this podcast on the Free-to-Air channel, you will be able to get hold of that. But this brings us to the end of the podcast, I think. We've mentioned the Patreon a few times. If you want to sign up to that, it's www.patreon.com/allstatsaren'twe. If you do sign up, it's very cheap. You can get all of our audio content for about £2.50 a month. That will get you all of the preview shows that we do. It will also get you bonus podcasts as well, and it will also give you access to all of the audio content that we have up there, which is a lot, believe me. So all there is for me to do is say thank you, Darren. It's been great just having a chat with you this morning.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that, John. Thanks.
Very good. And we'll see you all next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.